Hello, everyone. Welcome to Our Lives with Shannon Fisher. We've got an exciting show tonight. I've got two really great guests who are both very prominent in the field of dog training. They have co-authored a book called Let Dogs Be Dogs, and it is about understanding your dog and creating better human-to-canine communication, which then helps you develop a deeper relationship with your dog. And so I am very excited to welcome Brother Christopher from the Monks of New Skeet and Mark Goldberg. Welcome, guys.
Thank
Hi,
you
Shannon.
Very much
thanks
for
having
us. Nice to be here.
So, Mark, you are a nationally renowned dog trainer based in Chicago. And Brother Christopher, you are a monk at the monastery in New Skeet. How did the two of you originally meet to collaborate on this project?
I had the pleasure a number of years ago of attending a conference of the International Association of Dog Professionals, the IACP, canine professionals. And at that convention, their annual conference, I had the opportunity of meeting Mark, who at that time was president of the IACP. And we just sort of hit it off right away, but it led to actually a deeper connection in terms of just talking about our own approaches to dog training and issues that we saw routinely. It led to actually a deeper friendship, which, you know, Mark would come to the monastery a number of times, you know, maybe a couple of times a year. And in that time, we really got to know each other very well. And we also had the opportunity to just brainstorm about, you know, our different training techniques, our approaches to problems that we were seeing. I also had the opportunity of attending a seminar that Mark and another trainer, Martin Dealey, were teaching in Florida, which was a wonderful experience for me. Anyway,
excellent.
Basically, what it did is it just it germinated a friendship that the more that aged, I think we saw the common concerns that we had a promise for collaboration, for collaborating on another book. And so that's a very, very distilled answer to a process that took place over, you know, 10 years.
That's fantastic. Yes, relationship building, especially toward collaboration like that, definitely takes time and trust and mutual respect. So that's that is exciting. Well, I'll ask Mark now then. First things first, I laughed hysterically at the story about your grandparents having a succession of the same breed of dog named Taffy. Reading that in your book made me, I mean, I cackled out loud. I was on a plane when I was reading it, and everybody looked at me, and I just thought, if they only knew. But you you got into training dogs because your dog was hit by a car when you were a little boy. So tell me a little bit about that process and how you came to be a dog trainer.
Well, I was sort of a child bride to the dog training industry. My father's people were dog people, but my mother's people weren't. And as you noted, my paternal grandparents had a succession of black cocker spaniels, all of whom were named Taffy. And I think it was just a lack of creativity. You know, they found a name they liked and they just stuck with it over the years. And in fact, you know, we actually had to distinguish those dogs by numbers. So if they were telling a story or if I was, somebody would always say, was that Taffy 1, Taffy 2, or Taffy 3? And they sort of marked the passage of, you know, decades by the number tagged on that Taffy. But my mom was not a dog person, but eventually I prevailed upon her. I can be kind of persistent, you know, then this is a trait that, you know, I think I was born with. So my friend was mononucleosis. My mom got pretty sick. She had mono, and I nagged her mercilessly when she was defenseless. And so I remember the day she said, yes, you can have a dog. Just let me sleep. When I wake up, we'll talk about it again. So I did get a dog. His name was Gus. We tell a lot of stories about Gus in Let Dogs Be Dogs. But, you know, I was 11, Shannon, and I really didn't know anything about dog behavior, the stages, psychological stages of growth. All I knew was I loved my puppy. He was my best friend, and he followed me everywhere. But as he began to enter the teenage years, he entered his teenage years, frankly, before I did mine, right? So he hit that rebellious stage. Yeah, you know, before I did. And so I really didn't know what was coming. And that's when he started to run away from me. And one day he ran into the street and he got hit by a car. And fortunately, he was not killed. He was just mangled. And we got him patched back together. He needed some surgery and stuff. But that dog, by the way, lived till I was 29 years old. So he took me from 11 to 29 through my entire childhood. But as soon as he was healed up from his surgeries, my mother packed us both off to dog school because we lived on a road and she was pretty sure the dog would get killed. So she sent us all off to dog school, and that was really the beginning for me, because I was just bitten by this dog training bug, and it has not let go since.
Excellent, excellent. And Christopher, I understand you were already at the monastery when you were tasked with taking over the dog program. So how did that program fall into your lap?
Well, it was sort of an interesting little history. When you come to the monastery, you know, you're coming ostensibly for spiritual reasons, not to say that dogs and humans don't have a real spiritual relationship, but I was coming because I wanted to deepen my own relationship with God. And the fact that the monastery happened to be working with dogs and breeding German Shepherds, that was icing on the cake for me. I had grown up with dogs, but had never really trained them. And so when I came here, I helped out occasionally in the training kennel. One of the brothers, former brother Job, who was very involved in the obedience program here. I mean, I would help him usually once a week, but I didn't really go through a mentorship specifically. I mean, I helped, but then I was also doing other, you know, chores and work around the monastery during that initial year. Well, as it so happened, Brother Job and the abbot got into an argument, and Brother Job sort of made an abrupt decision to leave the community, and there happened to be probably about 8 or 9 dogs in the kennel at the time that were here for training.
Oh, my stars.
So given the fact that the training program was an important part of our livelihood, we had a meeting, and when the abbot sort of said, well, what are we going to do here? Everyone is tied up except, and they all looked at me, and they said, well, you're in a position where, you know, you're young enough and free enough to work in the training program. Would you be willing to try that? And so I said, well, I'd be willing to try it, you know, but I'm going to be sort of learning from scratch.
I'm a rookie, right?
That's right. So what Father Lawrence, the abbot at that time, said is, okay, fine, you know, it's your responsibility. And so all of a sudden I had the responsibility of training dogs that were coming to New Skeet for basic obedience training. And so essentially what I did during the first 6 months is I lived dogs. I ate, slept, drank, you know, dogs.
No, you didn't eat. Wait, hold on. You got to clarify. He never ate a dog. The brother Kirk,
I mean, basically, I took a cram course. We had an extensive library in both training material as well as animal behavior, dog behavior. And so I tried to read everything I could get my hands on. And naturally, this is sort of a laboratory because we had an established reputation by that time. New Skeet was recognized as being a place where people could bring their dogs for obedience training. And so essentially, for the first couple of months, I wound up training very, very long hours to make sure that the dogs when they were sent home, would be well trained. And naturally, I was learning both from our book, How to Be Your Dog's Best Friend, but then also a lot of other resources that we had. And so, lo and behold, after about 5 or 6 months, I realized, interestingly, that I was actually pretty good at training. It sort of uncovered a gift that I didn't really realize I had, and that
Excellent.
The dogs were going home well-trained, and that I was able to communicate sufficiently with the owners to help them understand what their responsibility was once the dog got home. And so that happened basically within the first year that I was in charge of the program here at Newskeet, which is 1982. And certainly I've been training ever since here at the monastery. I mean, I've been here at the monastery now 36 years. And so during that time, you know, you can imagine I've seen thousands of dogs. And so it's
Sure.
been a real honor and privilege to work for owners and to work with such a wide variety of dogs.
That is wonderful. I love that story. It was meant to be that you connect with these dogs, and you didn't even know it at the time. That's great.
Right.
Well, let's talk about the
yeah.
dogs. A lot of the book is about how we don't realize how much our own behavior that we don't even realize we're exhibiting affects our dogs, and the messages that they receive from our nonverbal cues and the true nature of a dog. So this one goes to Mark. So in the book, you talk about like the defense drive, the prey drive, the pack drive, and that it's kind of our job to control what natural drive our dog is in. So tell me a little bit about these basic drives for a dog.
Well, let's just pick out two of them really quickly. If you've ever seen a Chihuahua playing with a squeaky toy and shaking it and playing with it, that's a puppy in prey drive. Prey drive mm-hmm. is a natural function of canines, because these guys are, although they are domesticated, they are in some real sense domesticated from the wolf. So our best
right.
friends are domesticated wolves. So, but after this 30,000-year journey, the instincts have been modified quite a bit, but there are definitely vestiges of the wolf predator. So a dog chasing a ball is in prey drive, and that is an excited, happy drive that we cannot squish and we should not try and eliminate. But it's probably not appropriate during dinner, for example, when the family is at the dinner table. So there is a
right.
different sort of an instinct or drive at that point that we want to appeal to. And this, I think, is probably the most difficult to grasp, but the most important drive of all that people can learn about their dog, and that is a drive called pack drive. And mm-hmm. pack drive, dogs are pack animals, so they are inherently wired to follow some kind of strong, compassionate leadership in their life. They are drawn to it. And
mm-hmm.
Pack drive we would define as the urge to follow and cooperate with a leader. So if you know how to live with your dog, if you know how to approach your dog, you will find that the dog begins to look to you for guidance. And
mm-hmm.
when the dog is looking to see what it is that you want, if what you want is to play, most dogs are happy to do that. But if it's quiet time, it's pretty easy at that point to teach them to lay down on their place during dinner and just, you know, wait for a more appropriate opportunity to go into an excited drive. So I think most people are really familiar with dogs in excitement, but
mm-hmm.
what most of our clients come to us asking for is, I wish he would not be so wild. And Shannon, you mentioned before that people fail sometimes to realize how their behavior affects the dog. And it's so true.
Yeah.
I see a lot of our clients say, I wish he wouldn't be so wild. And then they immediately rile up the dog. like instantaneous, like they walk in the door and they go, baby, how are you? You know, and the dog is then going, you know, crazy, at which point the people immediately yell at the dog to stop.
Right.
So
really
we're just trying to help people.
Down, right? Yelling is going to calm the dog down.
Well, if the dog is barking and you're yelling, then everybody's barking, right? And nobody,
that's what
at that
I'm
point,
saying.
Nobody
exactly,
is,
exactly.
Right.
Nobody's
calm in charge.
Down if so everyone is yelling. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So
well, that
we teach a concept.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to summarize by saying we teach a concept called compassionate authority, so that people can learn how to exercise authority with their dogs in a compassionate way that makes dogs very, very happy indeed.
Definitely, yes. You guys talk about the different schools of thinking in dog training, and some are, you know, some are very authoritarian and perhaps even to the point of cruelty, especially historically, and some of the modern positive only are almost not working because there's no correction, and that there's one line out of your, it's not punishment, it's correction. And that really stuck with me. My favorite line in the book, dogs, like human beings, experience fulfillment based on the quality of their relationships, and this happens most naturally within the context of their pack. And I think a lot of people don't think about their relationship with their dog and that they're developing it just like they do a friendship or a family relationship. So I'll send this one to Christopher. What is mindful dog ownership? What is mindfulness, and how does that fit into the dog-human relationship?
I think that mindfulness is a concept that, as it applies to dog, first of all, recognizes the reality of the dog as the dog truly is. It's seeing, interpreting, and then responding to the nature, the real nature of the dog, instead of imposing prefabricated or human projections onto the dog that diminish the reality, the actual canine reality of the dog. And so by applying a mindful approach to training, what one is doing is you're taking into account the nature of the dog, and then you're mm-hmm. using your own human intelligence, your own human emotion and compassion to create and refine the relationship that you share with the dog in a way that allows its canine nature to blossom. Okay, that's mm-hmm. basically what good dog training is. Dog training is not simply imposing human will upon the dog in a way that dogs resent or that diminishes their reality. It's rather just the opposite. It is allowing the dog's true nature to flourish.
Mm-hmm.
The dog's nature
and
is not static. Yeah, you know, the dog grows into its own canine nature. And so by being mindful of the dog's nature as well as the reality in which the dog lives, okay, the context mm-hmm. of its life, the human owner has the responsibility to pay attention, to be awake, and to respond appropriately in the vast different experiences of daily life that they share with their dogs.
Sure, and every dog has a unique personality, and so I'll throw this out to both of you. You guys can decide who to take it first. What unique personality challenges have you met in certain dogs that have really struck you and stayed with you all these years?
Well, I'll go first. I can tell you probably one of the biggest problems we run into is when there is a mismatch in the energy level or the agenda, if you will, of the dog versus the owner.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I'm reminded of a very studious attorney, a lawyer, who she had lots and lots of office work to do, and she would have done very well with the kind of dog who just wanted to go out potty and come back inside. Of course, all dogs need mental and physical stimulation, and it's our job, our responsibility, as Brother Christopher has so aptly phrased it, to meet their physical and psychological needs. But certain breeds of dogs and certain individual dogs have lesser energy requirements, lesser mental challenge that they require to be fulfilled than other dogs and individuals and breeds. And so my very studious, very hardworking lawyer adopted a coon hound, which is a dog that is bred, right? And they're bred to live on farms and to run and to hunt and to be, you know, just barking to their heart's content, live in the barn, you know, not that a coon hound can't live in the house because they can't,
right.
But they just require an awful lot of sniffing and running and hunting. Otherwise, if you don't create some opportunity for a coon hound to do that, then you wind up with a very, very frustrated dog. And in those situations, that those dogs are eating the house. And that was, you know, that. So that's one that really stuck with me. Now, I'll just really quickly plant the idea before I throw it over to Christopher that for this client, the solution was to teach that dog a combination of come when called and to lay down and stay. Come when called was critical because this is the way that dog earned liberty. It was unsafe to let her run and play and do the sniffing mm-hmm. that her hound nature needed. It was unsafe to do it because when you called her, she would not come. But once she understood the come command, it was safe to let her run and play, and then also fair to tell her, now you've had your hour of play. I need you to give me 2 hours of come. And so compromise was reached, but that was a hard one. That was a hard won battle, I have to say. And it's usually easier if people do some research and match their own temperament before they adopt the dog.
Definitely, definitely. I've got two beagle mixes, both rescues, and they definitely present their own challenges.
Yeah, absolutely.
with
I can only imagine.
And their snouts leading them everywhere, but you have to know your breed. And I didn't realize before I had dogs how different each breed was. And each dog has a personality, each breed has a personality, and there's so much to learn in this world of dog training and dog loving. It's amazing.
That's one of the things.
Christopher,
that,
piggyback
a little bit on what Mark had said. Obviously, we see people who in their busy lives don't really appreciate what the actual needs of the dogs are. And when we help them understand what the exercise needs of the dogs are, of the individual breeds, and their psychological and mental requirements, and we help them frame that within a understandable and doable structure, which the dog understands and can depend on, what they see is the dog fitting into a rhythm and into a way of life at which the dog understands what the expectations are, its basic needs, its basic energy requirements are being met and fulfilled, and the relationship starts to flower. It's, however, amazing, as Mark indicated, that so many owners don't have a clue as to what the real requirements of dogs are. Instead, they sort of project onto the dog what they think a dog would want based on their own human projections. And it's
sure.
Once they understand, I think a little bit more realistically, what canines really value, you know, the resources that they really will work for and will find happiness and fulfillment in, that it sort of unlocks the relationship, and also it galvanizes the energies of the owner to go the extra mile and do what their unique dog needs for a happy relationship.
Definitely, and you talk in the book about how we're always staring at a screen, whether it's the television or our cell phones or a computer, and that disconnects us not only from the people in the room, but also from dogs. And if you're looking at your phone when you're walking your dog, that there's there's a deeper relationship. So so you talk about a technique called tethering, Christopher. So how does that bond you to a dog, and how can people really bond with the animal that they bring in the house?
Well, one of the things that we've done here, and I know Mark does the same thing as at his little dog farm, is that once an owner comes and picks up their dog who has been through a 2.5-week training session, we want to establish continuity between what the structure that the dog was living on here at the monastery, in the monastery training program, with what they'll receive at home. And so what we've found to be a real important technique, not only for small puppies, but also for dogs who are returning home, is for the owner, whenever the dog is in the presence of the owner has the dog with them, and they have a short tether or a leash attached to the dog, so that the dog winds up following the owner wherever the owner goes, throughout the house and then certainly on walks and play sessions, you know, outside. But as it relates in the house, it is remarkable how just simply, for example, if a person is sitting and, you know, writing a letter or working on the computer, and then all of a sudden they realize they want to get a cup of coffee, the dog is there on a downstay to simply pick the leash up, and the dog goes with you to the kitchen. Okay, then the dog goes back to, for example, the study, is on a downstay again, and then all of a sudden you remember you have something to do in the bedroom. Okay, you pick the leash up, the dog goes to the bedroom with you. What that is doing is simply, in a very simple way, is causing the dog to pay attention to the owner who is making the decision where they are going. Okay, so the dog is instinctively and in a very natural way looking towards the leadership of the owner in a way that is almost, you know, it's a very, very natural process. As opposed, so it's basically what it's showing is that training is going on essentially 24/7. It doesn't have to be simply divvied out into separate 15-minute training sessions with your dog. It can be taken into the entire life with your dog.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And there's in reading this book, and I highly recommend it to all of the listeners out there, you really, when you're talking about the stories about the dogs that you've trained and all of the little vignettes, you really can get a sense of the personality and the bond that people have with their dog or are building with their dog. And so, Mark, one of the tips that you have is to dogs need to understand what they can and can't control, and that you need to control the resources. So tell me a little bit about that, Mark.
Well, remember, it's sort of a different era today, but I go back to the you know, I'm old enough to remember the point in time where you sort of had to earn the car keys, you know, when you were a teenager. Mm-hmm. And, one of the sort of the more amusing internet memes I've ever seen was a list of chores that a father left for his son to do after school. And it said, when you finish this list, and it was, a reasonable list, but it said, when you finish this list, call me for today's Wi-Fi password, you know. And and if you think about it for a moment, what a clever, what a clever approach to like getting things done. And so just like human beings who we crave and want certain things, so do dogs. And there is a finite list of things that dogs really care about. And so in Let Dogs Be Dogs, we talk quite a bit about how not to deny those resources to your dogs, but how, in fact, to provide them in a way, in a sort of a similar way as that father was providing the internet password, you know, to his son, which was in return for some good behavior. And I want to stress, far from repressing the spirit of the dog, all of the material in Let Dogs Be Dogs is designed to ultimately liberate the dog, so that your dog learns what your expectations are, learns that you will fulfill his needs, but that in turn he must also fulfill yours. And what that gives a dog is a deeper understanding of you, gives you a deeper understanding of your dog, and makes both of you much safer and frankly eliminates a lot of the conflict and micromanagement that we have to do with dogs, or that some people do. So
sure.
Ultimately, a well-trained dog is a dog who is physically free to move around because he's safe and he'll come when called, but also knows how to not abuse the privilege.
Definitely, definitely. And you give some ideas about earning the trust of your dog in the process, and kind of giving your dog a massage and grooming your dog and taking your dog places to show that you take the responsibility seriously and that your dog is safe in your care. And I think people just don't think about, a lot of people don't think about the emotional needs of their dog and don't even really notice, you know, their facial expressions changing or the look in their eyes and the kind of difference in the way they look at you through different times of day. So for people out there who aren't really in touch with connecting with the dog on an emotional level, I'll throw this one to Christopher. How can they develop, in addition to training, that emotional connection to the dog?
I think by spending time, intentional time with the dog in a very structured and positive way. Naturally, there are plenty of resources that are available that help us read dogs' body language and help us understand the signals that dogs give in a way that is entirely often nonverbal. Okay, dogs obviously will vocalize, but they wear their emotions on their bodies, and people are sometimes absolutely deaf to what the dog is saying through its body. There are plenty of resources that can help owners have a general and I think pretty accurate understanding of what the dog is communicating through its body. However, I think that the more one spends time with the dog, the more that inner relationship, that sympathy, that bond develops. And you find yourself feeling the dog's energy in an entirely natural way, in a way that is not simply the human being projecting on the dog all sorts of, let's say, false or erroneous human emotions and projections. Rather, you're aware of the dog as an emotional creature, an autonomous creature. Okay, this is a different species. That's one of the remarkable aspects of the human-dog relationship, is that we are able to develop a relationship of this sort of depth with a creature of another species.
It's
remarkable. And I think that people of all different national backgrounds as well as religious backgrounds, one of the things, or even non-religious backgrounds, I think one of the things that is so compelling about the human-dog relationship is that there is something that people experience in the relationship with the dog that simply transcends what we understand about it. It touches on the level of mystery, and that, I think, gives people sort of an understanding or an experience of awe that they can actually have this sort of a relationship with another creature, that it becomes something deeply fulfilling, deeply meaningful in their lives. I mean, I've had very macho truck drivers, you know, who come to pick their dogs up at the end of a training session, and all they're breaking down crying at the reunion, you know, because of the depth of feeling that they experience with their dogs. It's not an uncommon experience, and I think what dogs unmask in us is our best nature.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. And that's that really kind of sums everything up, because they are constantly good. They're constantly in the moment, and so their intention is just bringing love and and following us and looking for leadership. And so they make us leaders if we step up into that leadership position, and they teach us more about ourselves and the world and the connection. One of the lines, dogs connect to the world not through their data plan, but through the richness of their senses. I love that, because that's humans used to do that too.
it's true.
Different
it's
senses.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. Well, we are winding down on time here, but let's close out the show with I'll ask each one of you what is the number one tip that you have to give people for training their dog. Let's start with Mark.
Well, Shannon, this is going to be very simple, and it's a little counterintuitive, so people might find this one really, really hard. But most of us like to carry on a running conversation throughout the day with our dogs, forgetting the fact that they don't speak English, let alone any other human language. and I hear so often, I would say the number one dog owner complaint of all the complaints that we get, the number one dog owner complaint has to be, he doesn't listen to me. But when you observe the client and the dog, you know, the client never stops yakking to the dog. And so my quick tip is, if you speak less, your dog will listen more.
Mm-hmm. It's something that I, as a monk, can certainly echo. And that's a very, very good tip. There are any number of tips in the book, plenty of tips that are based on our collective experience of working. You know, I think collectively we probably share about 70 or 80 years of dog training experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of tips. But one thing that I would highlight is this. Most owners think in human terms, and they think that applying structure to a dog's life is going to inhibit its freedom and make the dog dislike them, when actually, in terms of understanding the dog's true nature, dogs thrive on structure. They thrive when things are predictable. And so to the extent that you can positively apply a clear structure to the dog's day, one that the dog can rely on and which you can help fulfill, you're going to really experience a transformation in your relationship with your dog.
Excellent, and that's the perfect way to end this. You guys have such wonderful advice, and the book includes a long list of specific training methods for aggression, fear, anxiety, typical behavioral issues, socialization. I highly recommend it. It's called Let Dogs Be Dogs, and it's by Brother Christopher of the Monks of Newskeet and Mark Goldberg. Christopher and Mark, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having us, Shannon.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure being with you.
It has been a pleasure having you. And for Our Lives with Shannon Fisher, this is Shannon Fisher on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, signing off. See you next time.